Well, you know, like, it's good to be here. This is the front end of a great 5 days and nights of an investigation into Veritas, an investigation into the truth. What I'm going to do this evening will be very introductory. There's a lot more to come, so if you are still looking for the truth when the evening is over, feel you haven't found it, there's a lot more to come. We're going to look tonight at, in fact, what it is that founds our grasp of reality, and it's going to be belief. A point I want to make is, right off the bat, is that belief is fundamental to all of the things that we do, think, or say. When the student said, you mean belief like it's 5 o'clock? Sure. You look at your watch, and your watch says 7:52, which is what my watch says, and you could ask yourself, why do I believe that? Well, because it basically hasn't betrayed me before, and it is a digital watch, which means it's very modern, doesn't have these hands on it anymore or anything. It's really high-tech and a small compass. But I'm believing something just simply by looking at the watch. The same thing is true if I'm looking for God or looking to ground my life, looking for happiness. I even have to ask the question of whether happiness is a worthy thing to look for. Belief is a basic human activity. We have to believe in order to live. We have to believe even when we reason, because reason itself is founded on belief. We cannot prove that our reasoning powers are valid. We can demonstrate that if we don't use the laws of logic, we can't get anywhere, we can't speak, we can't talk, but then why should we talk? We can't demonstrate that some of the most primitive conceptions that undergird our lives are correct. For instance, all of us have a sense of ethics. We all behave as if some things were right and other things were wrong. Now, sometimes students will at least pretend to say the otherwise, and will pretend in a kind of, at Harvard, no-fault history, where students are not sure that you could fault anyone in the Third Reich for the kind of Holocaust that took place, a sort of no-fault history. There are some students who say that, but I'm sure that in their own lives, there are things that they believe are right and wrong, especially if they're done to them. But you can't demonstrate why it is that something is right or wrong. Why should your roommate treat you better than he or she does, right? Yeah, well, they should, shouldn't they? Well, why? Because it's good to be good. Why is it good to be good? What is the good? When you begin to ask these questions, you're delving into the realm of belief. There may very well be some real reasons, rational reasons for doing this, but at the bottom of all of them are going to be some kind of commitment that you simply have to make before you begin. Even in science, we can't prove that the universe is uniform, and yet if the universe isn't uniform, we can't do science. And we will always have to use that conception, or our work will be just simply won't get published, for one thing, if we go into the try to publish a paper on the chaos involved in hydrogen and oxygen coming together as water. Well, there may be a little chaos there, but it's fundamentally hydrogen and oxygen, two parts to one, and if you think that it's something else, you're going to have an awfully difficult time getting your paper published in the Kitty Gazette. Because everyone knows that believes, holds, you see, everyone knows, but they know because there's a sense of justified belief. Justified true belief is knowledge. But the question is, are our beliefs justified? So even in science, where we feel that there's a great number of our beliefs that are justified, it still means that at the foundation there is that fundamental commitment to the uniformity of the universe. There's also a fundamental commitment to the ability of the human mind to access reality. Why do you believe yourself when you look at the thermometer and it tells you that it's 100 degrees when water boils? Now, you're here at sea level, that is, sometimes the sea is a little 18 feet above what it was before, but you're here at sea level, so there'll be a little bit of variation in when the water boils. That depends upon the tides, I suppose. But the variation is all built into the notion. All things being equal, the water is going to boil if it's pure at the same temperature time after time after time. And if you said anything other than that, you'd have to really work hard to justify it by some kind of notion of some sort of uniformity that was going on with a variation that hadn't been noted yet. So belief is at the bottom even of science. And of course in religion and in spiritual matters, we can't in the final analysis prove with philosophic certitude that God exists, but we could certainly make some good cases for God, and I think you're going to hear that in the days to come. We can't in the final analysis prove that we exist for that matter. We can't prove in a fundamental sense that we are actually here. Do you know that Chuang Chao, about 5 centuries before BC, Chuang Chao said that he had dreamed the night before. He had dreamed that he was a butterfly. And this morning when he wakes up, he can't tell whether he's the butterfly now dreaming his Chuang Chao or Chuang Chao having dreamt he was a butterfly. Can you prove to yourself, just to yourself, not to me, not to anybody else, but can you prove to yourself that you're really here? You sure you're not dreaming? How would you demonstrate to yourself that you weren't dreaming? Did you ever think that you weren't dreaming when you were? Did you ever have a dream that was so vivid that you were sure that it was true? And most of these dreams, by the way, are not good ones. They tend to be nightmares, and aren't you glad when you wake up? But are you sure you're not dreaming now? A rather good dream, or a little bit better dream, or maybe a mediocre dream, or maybe a very, very boring dream. But are you dreaming? Well, most of you here believe that you're not, and I think you're right. I believe that you're not dreaming either. Well, if I could see better with these lights in my face, I'd be a little more clear about that. There were some people who were dreaming yesterday when I spoke at Pepperdine. The question is not, can we prove our beliefs with mathematical or philosophic certitude? The question rather is, why should we believe one thing rather than another? Can our beliefs be reasonable? The scope of this lecture is going to primarily focus on those sorts of beliefs that are life-orienting. Is there a God? If there is a God, what is he like? Do we owe God anything? What, if anything, makes life worth living? The big questions. I'm not going to deal with very many answers to that. We are going to look at the Christian faith as one way of looking at this together toward the end of the talk. But at the first part, most of the time, we're simply going to deal with the question of why you should believe anything at all, from whether your watch is telling you the truth about time or whether God is there. What do we have to justify our beliefs? Now, we could look at our beliefs along 2 spectra. And for that, we'll need the first chart that's up here. See, some of our beliefs... am I mic'd? Yes, I am. Well, thank you. Some of our beliefs are certain, some are doubtful, some are specific, and some are vague. You look across the spectra, you have all of those kinds of things going on. For instance, some of you, not me, I wasn't raised quite this way, but some of you were probably raised in a situation in which you were taught what to believe. You took some confirmation classes or catechism classes, and there you are. You have learned the answers to a whole bunch of questions. They're specific answers, and because you were taught, or for whatever reason, you said, well, that's right. I'm not going to be misled, and so you went ahead and believed them. And they were specific. Maybe a lot of things were specific. Perhaps you memorized the whole of the Shorter Catechism or the Westminster Confession of Faith. We'll try that one for size. Some people's beliefs are very specific. There is a seminary in the United States which used to have a 32-page statement of beliefs, and you had to sign off on that statement before you could graduate. What do you have to sign off on here before you can graduate? Well, you have to satisfy 32 pages of professors. Now, on the other hand, there are folk whose beliefs are pretty vague, you know, maybe raised on just on television, and you're over here and my grandkids are Barney freaks, one of them especially, and I've watched some Barney tapes with Derek, and you know what Barney does. What do you learn from Barney? I remember a tape on sharing. Isn't that nice? You should share. Everyone should share. One of my grandsons says, share. He says, share. And he goes over to his brother or his cousin, and he shares what his brother and his cousin has. Very interesting definition of share. And then, of course, there's Mr. Rogers. It's a lovely day in the universe. Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you be my neighbor? Take that into the dormitory. How long does it last with your roommate? Won't you be my neighbor? Well, one hopes so, but if you have to have a lot more than this kind of vague, general sort of morality or rules to rule your life. You need more. And in fact, sometimes you get challenged on this. Life may not be capable of being so joyful and so ebullient as Barney would like to have you believe. You can get into some pretty sticky stuff, and you begin to doubt then perhaps some of that that you've had. And in fact, what really happens is that some of us who are raised like this, pretty certain, man, it goes all the way down here. And some of us, when we go to the university, you lose not only the answers to the questions in the catechism, but you lose the questions. You can't remember the questions anymore, and you certainly don't remember the answers. So there you are, rather vague. Or perhaps you start down over here, and you meet a professor on campus, and she is just absolutely brilliant. Very, very, very convincing. And after a few weeks in her class, you've come up with a very certain and specific belief, and there you are, a Marxist. Well, Kelly Monroe, only at Harvard. I once suggested that worldviews and notions could be falsified, and I used Marxism as an illustration. I'd just been to Romania, and I didn't have any problem saying that Marxism had been basically falsified, certainly in that culture. And one of the students, international students, this was in Leuven, Belgium, he began to object. I found out later that his father was an ambassador from a communist country. Didn't want his faith to be falsified. But one does lose track of where orienting, not yet, one does lose track, down boy. He's going to disappear. I'm going to lose him. I know. One does shift. You go to the movie. That's kind of neat that Star Wars is back again, isn't it? And you come across Yoda. You know, good old plastic Yoda, good old plastic Zen. Yoda teaches you. And here's what Yoda teaches you. Yoda teaches you what? Well, if you're stuck in the mud and you've got your spaceship down in the mud, what are you supposed to? How are you supposed to get it out? The Force. Yes, the Force. Turn off your mind, Luke, Obi-Wan Kenobi says. Turn off your mind, Luke. And Yoda says, trouble we have. Luke, don't try, Luke. Do. That help you in calculus when you have your next exam? Well, not very much. So you say, that's really fascinating. Let's see if I can learn some more. And you do, you read D.T. Suzuki, you read some Zen texts, you begin meditating, and you become certain. At least you become committed, you feel that something is happening, and you now perhaps are meditating according to the methods of some particular Zen Buddhist master, some Roshi. And there you are, certain. We move in our beliefs. We change. We shift. We grow. Well, we decline, too. Some of us have declined a little further than others. But we change our minds. I want to ask three questions. The first question is a thought question. I'll let you just answer it for yourself. The second one is two. And the third one I'm going to answer, give you some answers that you would give me if I asked you, because I know I've done this many times and gotten answers from students, and I'm going to give you the kinds of answers that you would give if you had a chance. The first, oh, you don't believe me, do you? All right, well, try me and see if a lot of the ones that were on that video, which I just saw when I came in here, aren't also on the chart, on the sheets that I'm going to put on the board. The first question is, where are you on the chart? Now, you say you can identify yourself, you've got a name for yourself, you're a post-apocalyptic, anti-charismatic Catholic, very specific. Or if you're, sorry, but if you're a Missouri Synod Lutheran, to see not very many people in here in Missouri Synod Lutherans, or they either laugh or groan or get up and walk out. Because if you are in that tradition or many other traditions, you know what you are. You will have been taught, you will have been trained, and you either that or you have denied it. Or you're on the way back and forth between the two. Because it's very, very specific and is very certain. At least it's taught as if it's very certain. If you're that kind of a person, then you're up over here on that side. If, on the other hand, you just can't identify what you are at all, you're over on the vague side, and maybe if you have very few reasons or can't figure out whether the things that you're orienting your life around, then you're doubtful and vague. It's very difficult to be in the doubtful and vague position, and yet it seems to me that students in general are in this area. Not a criticism, just a description. And it's a tough area to be in. To be doubtful, whether you're specifically doubtful or doubtful about specifics, or whether you're vague and can't quite put it all together and doubtful about that. It makes decisions extremely hard. What if you come to the university and your goal is law school and you keep flunking all of the courses like poli-sci and so forth, or you want to go to med school and you can't get past chemistry? See Dr. Kennedy. He's retired now. He'd be glad to take you as a tutorial, right? Oh, sure. He's just headed out to the beach. But it's a tough thing to have to decide what to do when the plans that you've made don't work out in the area of career, in the area of your mate or your lack of one. What you'd like to be the case just turns out not to be the case. What do you do? What makes life worth living? It would be very good if you had a good, solid set of beliefs that work together and fit together and around which you could orient your life. Well, that's the first question. The second question is, if you had to give yourself a reason for why you were where you were, what would you tell yourself? How many reasons can you give for where you are? Student at Swarthmore could give 9 reasons. That's a challenge. That's a lot of reasons for being where they are on the chart. Can you give yourself 1, 2? You can, if you think about it, do exactly that. But wasn't it puzzling? It was very interesting to me to find out that the students who were interviewed had such a hard time with the question. Do you know what a student at Tennessee, University of Tennessee, said as he came up to a table at which the question, why should anyone believe anything at all, was plastered across the back of the table? He'd seen that question on posters around the campus, and what he said was, oh, there's that question again. It makes my head hurt. And he walked off. He came back a few minutes later, and the students handed him a sheet and said, well, why don't you write down what you believe about that question? Why should anyone believe anything at all? And he took the piece of paper and he looked at it and he said, I can't do it. And he walked off. You see, underneath the questions that we ask about what we should believe is this terrible issue of why. And it is true, it's a question that's relevant to every person, every place, every time, every space. Why do you believe what you believe? The third question is, why do people believe what they believe? And I'm going to put on the chart several, you can put number 1 up now, thank you, several ways of looking at this. We'll start off with a couple of answers which we hope aren't true. Because if they are, we've got some real problems. One of the ways that some students will say, well, after all, the reason people believe what they believe is that they're brainwashed, you know, or that it's a crutch. It's just something that gets them by, and they have been coerced into believing it. Coercive persuasion is the more formal way of putting that. But you've been manipulated. The sort of thing that might be the case with someone like were interviewed from Heaven's Gate. At least one of my sociology friends thinks that there is at least one person who was interviewed after the Heaven's Gate affair that was really coercively persuaded, that his mind really had been manipulated by the group. If that's the case, then of course that's not a very good reason. In fact, it's not a reason at all. It's simply a cause. And so is the second one, the sociobiological reason. Some people feel that genetic determination has a great deal to do with not just what we look like and how bright we are, but rather even with what we believe. And a full exegesis of that is forthcoming, one thinks, or at least a kind of a claim to that will be forthcoming from E.O. Wilson. Again, I don't know why Harvard comes up so much, but E.O. Wilson is a Harvard sociobiologist who holds that view and has tried to reduce all knowledge to materialistic knowledge. And the materialistic basis for who we are and how we behave and what we think is the genetic makeup, is something to do with our biological, biophysical makeup. But if that's true, if it's just determined, then there really isn't anything that we can do but what we do. There is then no possibility for rational reasoning about it at all. It just happens to us. And if it happens to us, it's not a reason. It's a cause. And that's going to be true of the next category that I put up. A little more possible reasons. In fact, not only are they possible, but they actually are factors that I want to suggest actually operate. One of them, the first category, is a category of sociology or the societal reasons. Parents, friends, society, culture, in that kind of an order. First, your first family, then the family of friends, your school, your peers, your social group that you become involved with, the society at large, and then, of course, the whole culture in which a particular society is rooted. These have our reasons that are given for belief. We'll go back and look at those again, but we'll look at the second one because I want to go through them first. The second one is the psychological. There's a set of psychological reasons: comfort, peace of mind, meaning, purpose, direction, hope. Isn't that what was primarily the answers from the students? When this question is asked and a survey is taken, something like 40 to 60% of the students will have answers in this category. I mean, if you don't have something to live for, if you don't have something to believe, that student kept saying over and over again, well, you just, how can you do it? Where can you go? And so there are social reasons and there are psychological reasons: hope, sense of identity, peace of mind, comfort. These all are aspects and factors that enter into why people believe. Let's take the third one, the religious reasons. Some people will say, well, it's in the book, or it's in the scriptures. It's in my pastor told me, or my priest, or the guru, or a channeler. Careful who I ask to beam me up. God told me. You know, something direct, something really religious, something in which one experiences perhaps the very presence of a voice or the presence of kind of some ecstatic experience. Religious factors. And the last set of factors, I think we're going to hold on for that, because that's the one that I really want us to come back to. Let's go back to the societal factors first. We want to ask the question, not why people do believe, but rather why people should believe. Now, are these good reasons for belief? They work, right? We've already agreed, and I don't think there's any argument about that, that the thing that you were when you woke up to find you were anything was because of your parents, your friends, and your society. I was raised in northern Nebraska. I was raised about a couple hundred miles from Wounded Knee, but I could never have woken up and discovered that I was a Native American. I could have been a nominal Catholic, a nominal Protestant, and not much of anything in between, but I could never have been a Hindu or a Buddhist. Now, Hindus and Buddhists were pictures in the National Geographic when I grew up in the middle of the 1940s. But that's all they were to me. It wasn't that I didn't believe they existed. I suppose if I'd been asked, I probably would have been able to say, well, there's some funny dressed people that are in that magazine, and yeah, they're there. But that would be the impact of that society on me, almost zero. But what was the impact? What did impact me? Well, the people who were around me, my parents, and the kids at school. I was raised a kind of a nominal Protestant. I was at school with some kids who were a little bit more serious Catholics. those were the two things that were available to me. I hardly thought anything about somebody who didn't believe anything, although I knew some of our ranching friends didn't do that. They were there. I could have been influenced by that. I really wasn't very much. But the point is that when I woke up to be what I was, I woke up within a context of Christian teaching and discovered at that particular point that I wasn't where I thought I ought to be, and I became a Christian fairly quickly when I found out what it was all about. But the factors that led to that included a great number of these things having to do with parents, friends, and society. But if, and think about this, if the only reason you are what you are turns out to be one of these factors, is that a strong, is that a good reason? Is it a weak reason? Is it a poor reason? Well, frankly, it's not, again, a reason at all. It's a cause. It's a cause. So if you are what you are because, solely because of that, then you have been caused to believe what you believe. Now, my suspicion is that that's not characteristic of very many college students. You're old enough, you've thought a little bit about it, and while you may not have done much thinking, my guess is that there are other things that are going on besides your culture. But your culture has had a tremendous impact on why you believe what you believe. The problem is that it's not a good reason for staying where you are. What's the problem with staying where your parents are? Why is it not a very good reason? They might be wrong. They might be wrong. They might be weighed and found no veritas in them. They might be wrong. Well, of course they might be wrong. They had you, didn't they? Though they had me, too, so I didn't have anything to say about it. You know, suddenly there I was. I cry, therefore I am. They might be wrong. Has a culture ever been wrong? Of course. Ask people in Eastern Europe whether a whole system of orientation can't be fundamentally flawed, and you will have almost universal response. Of course it can be fundamentally flawed. Very, very few, thoughtful, theoretical Marxists, at least of the type that was ruling Eastern Europe. There may be other types of Marxists, but not the type that was embodied in Eastern European cultures. That's been falsified. Doesn't work. Soviet man never appeared, nor did Soviet woman. Now that would be something, wouldn't it? Cultures, even fundamental conceptions in cultures, can be wrong. So it's not a reason. If you're forced into this or enculturated into this, it's not a reason at all. If you have been influenced by it, you've thought about it, and that's the only thing you've got to think about, then it's not a very strong reason. Second one. This is the psychological category again, please. Now, are these good reasons? Well, they are reasons. They really are. If something gives you comfort, gives you hope, gives you peace of mind, a sense of identity, helps you to live, gives you a purpose in life, should you believe it? Well, it's a reason. Is it a strong reason? Let me put it this way. If someone offered you all of these things and said, you know, you just come and you believe this, you leap into our circle of faith, and you got it, baby, you're in. And you get all of these things, and you pass your tests too. But you got all of these things. Very convenient. Now, there are some religions or religious orientation, spiritual movements that actually offer that. I've seen posters saying that you can have all of that stuff plus a whole bunch of other stuff if you simply meditate on a mantra that costs you $125. I expect the price has risen since I saw that poster. But you got all of that stuff. Should you believe it because it's offered? No. No. People offer things all the time. Not because of the offer. Should you believe it if it actually pans out? Well, that's better. But how long would you like to be comfortable and happy and peaceful and have a meaningful existence? How long? Some students say, well, until you die. At which I respond?
And then?
Well, you know, at the end of your physical life, you're just gone.
Really?
Why do you believe that? Well, you are, aren't you?
Really? I don't think so. Oh?
You see, the problem is that you want this in the longest run, and it may not give it to you in the longest run. So there are things that will work. In fact, I suspect right here in Santa Barbara, you could find something that would make you really happy until you died. And do you know what would happen to you tomorrow? They'd call your parents and ask you to pick them up because you're at the morgue. You could go out on a high, and it wouldn't cost you too much to do it. Just a little bit of a drug overdose. Too expensive. Another expensive drug was thalidomide. Thalidomide was a drug that was used by women to solve problems of pregnancy. And it worked. Morning sickness was relieved, and so were the limbs of those who were born. They were born with, oftentimes, without fully developed limbs, appendages. Terrible tragedy. Worked for a while, but it cost way too much, and it didn't last very long. So these are psychological reasons. They are important, they are helpful, but there has to be something else going on. Now, what if those psychological reasons that you have worked in the absolutely longest run? They lasted until a reasonable length of your life panned out, and they lasted beyond that down to the reaches of eternity. Would that be a good reason? Well, I should think so. And it probably would mean that the things that you were believing were not just psychologically valid and psychologically useful, but that they would be what? True. True. So it's a kind of a test for truth that involves experience, but it's a limited test because it's limited to experience, and the experience that we're looking for, the experience that we have, is an experience this side of the grave, excepting perhaps for a very few people, and namely, primarily, one. So psychological reasons. Third set of reasons are the religious reasons, and you should think that since we're talking primarily about orienting values, that this would be helpful to us, and in a way it is, and in a way it's not. I believe because it's in a book, it's in scripture, it's in the Quran, it's in the Bible, it's in the Bhagavad Gita, it's in the channeled wisdom of Shirley MacLaine, using wisdom with a certain degree of equivocation. It's in the book. You know, I mean, and I'm sure that a number of you here will say, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, I believe the Bible. Isn't the Bible true? Shouldn't I believe it? Well, that's the question. Is the Bible true? Is the Quran true? Does the Bhagavad Gita tell you the truth about spiritual reality? It's a very important question. If it does, what should you do? You should believe it, right? So it may very well be that some of these, like your parents, by the way, might tell you the truth too, and that would be fine if they did, and it would make what they told you worthy of belief. But just because it's said by a book, or a pastor, or a priest, or a guru, or a challenger, there we go again. The challenger blew up. It doesn't necessarily make it true. What about the last one? God told me. Let me try you out on this argument. By my definitions for the moment, God tells the truth, he wants you to know, and he tells you something. Should you believe it? God is a good God. He'd like you to know, and he tells you. Should you believe? You're having a hard time with this one, aren't you? Actually, the answer to this is yes. But it's set up, because God is a good God. God tells you. He wants you to know. Then, of course, what's the problem? Is it God? Did I hear right? So the issue then is the problem of whether when you have received some kind of message, whether the message has come from a trustworthy source, and whether if it seems to be God, it really is. And if it is God or a God, is this God a God of the truth? Is this God a God of veritas? Now, I don't want to eliminate these by any means. But what I do want to say is that they are primarily sources for truth. Sources of information which can be checked out. And they are a rich source of information. And they are a contradictory source of information. Since when you lay out all the things that are offered for belief, that are stated by these sources, you're going to find that they don't agree with each other. So given that situation, now you've got all of these claims, sometimes to truth, sometimes just it's a neat story and you ought to believe my story because I'd like to have you believe my story. It's sort of a postmodernist way of doing it. I hope I can get you to use my language. Truth is anything I can get you to agree to. But even that is a claim to truth, a claim to the way to understand language, a claim to the way to understand reality. And what you need is a test for these claims. And that leads us then to the last category, which when students are asked this in a public forum, usually they don't come up with these things. Now, what they do come up with are elements that go into this category, like experience, that goes in here. Evidence goes in here. The results of good science goes in here. The results of historical study goes in here. There are all kinds of things that go into this category that help us determine whether something is true or not. But the tests for truth, when one puts all of this together, really boil down, I think, to these three, which I've tried to explain a little bit further by the items in the parenthesis. Consistency or logic, or what some people would say is reason. This is not, as I'm understanding it, not as I'm using it, this is not a contentful subject. Reason, as I'm using it, or consistency, as I'm using it, has no content. It is rather a methodology. What it means is that what you believe in one place and hold to be pretty likely to be true needs to square with what you believe in another place. It needs to be consistent with that. If it's inconsistent, then something is wrong. Either both things that you believe are wrong or one thing that you believe is wrong, but at least one of the two things that contradict have to be wrong. And I give an illustration of this. If you believe in the value of individual human beings and that you as a person are valuable, ultimately valuable, and valuable down through the reaches of eternity, that you have a final value for the longest run, then you'd better not believe in reincarnation. Because reincarnation says, no, you, as you understand yourself today with your personality, temperament, character, and history, are just a local habitation for a short period of time. You have been many people in the past, you will be many people in the future, or perhaps you'll be a gnat or an elephant, but you're going to be different and it's going to take a long time for you to ever be anything other than one of these kinds of people. And eventually, maybe, if you work at it and you get your karma all worked out, you'll be able to become unified with God. But you won't be you. You will be one. This is at least the Advaita Vedanta system of Hinduism. Now, what that means is then that if you believe in reincarnation, then you cannot believe in the value of your individual character, because your individual character and personality is going to be shifted and changed. And there are people in the Western world who pick up the notion, two notions, the value of the individual, and secondly, the notion of reincarnation. But when you put them together, they don't fit. Something is wrong. Which is it? Consistency won't tell you which is right, but it will tell you whether one of them has a problem or both of them have problems. Coherence says that what you believe about human beings, what you believe about life after death and God and the world and value and so forth, they should fit together like a hand and a glove that really fits. And they should support each other so that when you recognize, for instance, that one of the beliefs is that you're valuable far down into the reaches of eternity, another belief is that you're made in the image of God. Now that fits very nicely with that idea. You're made in the image of God, the eternal, and you represent one of his creatures, and you're going to represent that personality for as long as there is, well, it's forever. Not just as long as if, it's forever. Because you begin, but you never end. You're created infinity. And that's a nice collapsing of it. Well, how does that fit with other things? It can fit with a conception of a God who is a creator. And a God who wants this to happen for you, who wants you to be valuable and so forth. So there's a way in which coherence of ideas help to support the truthfulness or help to support the truth claim. The last one, completeness, that's the doozy. Because what that means is that the belief system takes care of all the data you would like to have explained. All the evidence, all the experience, all the counter-experience, all the counter-evidence, all of the things that you would like to have answered, somehow the belief system does the best job of treating those issues. And the system of offered for belief that does the best job of treating those issues is, under this notion, the most likely to be true. Now, you'll notice that I haven't said that you can prove with final, with a finality that something is true. What you can do is demonstrate that it's more likely to be true than something else. That's the search. And it may take a long time for you to do this. Now, you've got 5 days of people who are going to talk about a variety of ways in which this kind of complex comes together. And I'm not going to give you very much of that tonight, just a taste of what that might look like tonight. But the goal will be to pull together all of your experience, all the things you think are so, and see it fit together nicely. And to listen to those who have systematic presentations or presentations which have a lot of the system to them, listen to those, examine them, evaluate them in terms of your own experience, in terms of the experience of others, and you'll begin to get a sense of whether what you are offered for belief or what you already believe has some reason for being true, or maybe what you already believe maybe should be abandoned and you should look for something else. Doubt and even nihilism are the route between belief systems. So you may have to abandon some beliefs in order to find the truth. And what you want to do is abandon those beliefs which are not true in order to get to those beliefs which are true. It can be a tough thing. Search for truth can be a tough thing. Now, as I said in the beginning, I'm going to give you a sort of a brief outline of where you would go to see whether the offer of truth that the Christian faith makes might be true. And now is the time to hand out the sheets that were duplicated. While these are being handed out, I'm going to start through a description. When I'm finished with the description, I'm going to open up for questions. If you're going to test the truth claims of the Christian faith, how would you do it? What essentially are the truth claims of the Christian faith? In a very simple way, the first one is that there is a God who is infinite and personal and loving, and he's made us in his image because he wants us to be in fellowship with him. He's made the whole earth. He's put us here, given us a freedom to live out our lives, a personality that is much like his, but we've blown it. And God has not left us on our own. When we have rebelled against him, we found ourselves separate from him, and therefore the inklings that we have and the intuitions that we have of God are not fully fledged. They're not beefed up. If we had not lost our original relationship with God, then we would have a pretty good idea of the truth that we need to know. But Christianity says that there is that truth. We are blind to it, and God doesn't want to leave us in blindness, and so he has revealed himself through the prophets of the Hebrew Scriptures, and then through Jesus, who comes to be God among us, Emmanuel, God with us, to show us what he is like, and then to provide for us what we cannot provide for ourselves, a way back to God. To stand in our place, he takes the broken relationship on himself and the implications of that, which are separation from God forever. He takes that on himself, on the cross, pays the penalty, and now gives us the freedom to become his children, to be reconciled to him again, and then to live a life that is in relationship to God. Now, that is a really brief sort of outline. But then what are the demonstrations that you might look at, the things that you might look at to see if these are true? Number one is Jesus himself. The best presentation of what the Christian faith is simply Jesus anyhow. So why not go to Jesus to get the best expression of that? And what I would suggest that happens in this process, as you do this, you begin to see what Jesus was like. If you read the Gospels, you get to see what Jesus was like. And he begins to come not just an abstract being or some kind of fictional character in a book, but their life comes into this character. And you begin to ask questions about it. He's a surprising person. And you will be surprised, I guarantee, you will be surprised at what you find. Jesus is not like what any of us think. And each time I come to Scripture, almost every time any case when my brain's turned on, there's something I see that wasn't there before. And it's, oftentimes it's a surprise, but it is certainly a surprise for those who haven't really read the Bible very much, or those who read it a long time ago. You know, to be kind, let me say this, and I want to say it in a kind way. If you're not one who is already a Christian or a believer in Jesus, my suspicion is that you do not know enough about Jesus to make a rational decision. I would not ever call someone to simply decide on the basis of my saying so. But look, take a look, come and see. Can any good thing come out of the Scripture? Yes, Jesus, come and see, take a look. Second, you need to have some kind of basic confidence that the stories that are told in the Gospels, which is where you learn about Jesus, that these are reliable. And there is a tremendous amount of information around in universities, including this one, that we ought to be highly skeptical of the New Testament documents. Okay, go ahead, be highly skeptical of the documents and take a look not just at the results of skeptical scholarship, but take a look at some of the books that I've got here who deal with that kind of skepticism and see if maybe you've been played false by those who are highly skeptical of the historical reliability of the Gospels. I think you really are. If you're wrapped up in, there's lots of contradictions in the Bible and Jesus couldn't have done this and he couldn't have said that. Look again. There are very good reasons for thinking that the character who is in the Gospels is historically reliable, that this is the person who actually did exist. So look at it, look it carefully, and don't let your doubts just simply say, well, there's no reason to take a look. See if there is. Check it out. Third one is the internal coherence and consistency of the Christian worldview and its power to explain all kinds of things. That's the completeness side. The completeness side. And the completeness side involves Jesus. Can you explain Jesus in any other way than the way the gospel says? Can you explain the existence of morality, the foundations for morality, the foundations for reason? Can you explain those better than is explained by the biblical worldview? And I would suggest that no, you can't, but then of course that's just a statement. You need to check it out for yourself. Another one is the inherent attractiveness of the Christian worldview and religion against the alternatives. I've written a book on this called The Universe Next Door, in which I talk about theism, deism, naturalism, nihilism, existentialism, Eastern pantheistic monism, the New Age, and postmodernism. It's 240 pages of easy reading. Try it before you go to sleep at night. You get a nice long night's rest. But take a look at the options and see if they really are as good as they look. Check it out. The fourth reason is the testimony of the adherence to the faith. And those of you, I'll talk for a moment to those of you who are believers. When you tell your story, don't make yourself, you know, the form of the story is, once I was lost, I was awful, and now I'm wonderful. Don't make yourself more lost than you really were. You're lost, you're quite lost enough. Ask your roommate. And don't make your life changed as it is after encountering Christ and experiencing his salvation and meeting him in quiet times and in worship. Don't make your life now claim to be rosy, because your roommate knows that isn't true either. Just tell the truth and it will be very adequate, because it will be honest, it will be true, and it will be a story with victory of a kind. So I would suggest that you tell your story that way. And those of you who have friends that are believers, listen to their stories, see what they say. And finally, a very ambiguous one. Probably the best reason for not being a Christian is the history of the Christian church. Sorry, it's true. South Africa turned into a positive, hasn't it? Ireland, still negative. The Crusades, well, at least they're over, but they're awful. You know, the Inquisition, not any longer, but at least it's over, as awful as it was. We have not done well by each other, even within the Christian faith, treating each other. So it's ambiguous. But remember that throughout the world, there are hospitals with crosses on the top and St. Luke's on the name. Everywhere in the world where it's possible to have a building with a cross on it. Not Saudi Arabia, because it's an Islamic state, you can't do that. And not Bhutan, it's a Buddhist state, strangely enough. It's a Buddhist state, and you can't do it. Marxism is pretty much gone, so that threat is over. But there are places now in all of those all of those places where the church is there not just as an evangelist going around trying to convince people to become Christians, but is there serving people. And that is probably the one of the best testimonies to the truth of the Christian faith and to the embodiment of the character of Jesus in the church. Where we don't embody Jesus in the church, then we are to be faulted. And we should, as Christians, be willing to allow ourselves to be faulted by those who say, you're hypocrites. Yes, you are. Yes, we are. A lot of us. But which kind of hypocrite would you like to be? One inside where God forgives hypocrisy and where he changes your life and helps you be less a hypocrite than you ever were before? Or just want to be a hypocrite of another kind? The church is for all of us as broken people. And the church witnesses to that, and the church down through the ages has done so. Well, that is the case that I would want to make in terms of why should anyone believe anything at all. Look, you're looking for truth. You're looking for veritas. You're looking to see whether claims to truth are true. Now, I've talked about the Christian religion as and the kind of way in which you might test out that claim, but there are other religions, and some of them I know a little bit about, and some of them I don't know much about. I'm willing to take a question that might come on any of those lines, and if I don't know what I...